Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishopriggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes. To keep in touch with us, use our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram and Twitter, which are all at Q and Review. That's CUEANDREVIEW. Or get in touch via information@qandreview.com. That's information at CUEANDREVIEW.com. Please like and share our podcast and give us any constructive feedback.
From the news section of The National, Monday the 12th of July 2021. The BBC accused of omitting facts in NHS story with Westminster decision pinned on the First Minister, by Greg Russell. BBC Scotland has been accused of being nasty clever by not making clear that the Scottish Government does not have the power to unilaterally approve a cannabis-based medicine for an 8-year-old boy who has hundreds of seizures a day. The broadcaster featured a story on its website about Marie Gray, who suffers from Duse syndrome, a complex type of epilepsy. Karen, his mother, said Marie had initially responded to Epidiolex, one of only three cannabis-based medications approved by the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, the MHRA. However, this had caused serious side effects, and she'd been paying up to £1,300 a month for private prescriptions for Bedrolite, sourced from the Netherlands, and his brother Dean, 13, had written to Nicola Sturgeon to ask for help paying for it. However, the First Minister responded to say medicine had to be proven to be safe before it was available on the NHS. The BBC said only Epidiolex can be prescribed by the NHS in Scotland, a point the National reader Greg Bryan picked up on. He said the BBC have been nasty clever. I've no problem admitting it. BBC journalism has some really talented writers, but this one wrote an article about a Westminster decision and its impact on a sick child, all done in such a way as to have me believing it was Nicola Sturgeon's fault. It was, as much as me pains me to admit it, a brilliant job. He said that critically the story stated, since legislation in 2018, only three medical cannabis products have been licensed by the UK-wide Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, the MHRA. Only Epidiolex can be prescribed by the NHS in Scotland. They're the completely true but also misleading bit right there. You can just hear the unionists screaming, see, those incompetents in NHS Scotland teaming up with that Sturgeon woman are denying this boy the free access to medicine he so desperately needs. Hell, even I was troubled by it, especially when you're led along by the nose with that headline, First Minister rejects brother's cannabis oil plea. If the BBC were being honest about it, they'd have said only Epidiolex can be prescribed by the NHS anywhere in the UK, Scotland or elsewhere. Brain added, this is because drugs policy is a reserved matter, one that the SNP government has repeatedly asked to have devolved, often specifically citing cannabis-based medicines as one of the reasons. The First Minister didn't approve the use of Bedrolite for poor wee Murray, because she can't. Young Dean should actually be writing to Sajid Javid, our new Westminster Health Secretary. Of course, the BBC left out that one tiny detail, which actually lays this all at Westminster's feet. This information is all there in the article, but you already have to know the BBC's misleading angle to spot it. But BBC Scotland defended their coverage of the story, which a spokesperson said was reported fairly and accurately. The spokesperson said the family wrote to the First Minister to ask for either help in funding or for her to influence the NHS to make it available. The story makes it clear that the UK regulator decides what drugs can be prescribed, and it included a section from the First Minister's response explaining why she was unable to help with funding. So both the family's position and the First Minister's response were reported in detail by Greg Russell. From the news section of The National, Monday the 12th of July 2021. Devolved nations must consent before changes to Human Rights Act, say MPs, by Greg Russell. A cross-party committee of MPs and peers has said the UK government should not try to reform the Human Rights Act, the HRA, without consent from the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Senate and the Northern Ireland Assembly. The Joint Committee on Human Rights report, the government's independent review of the Human Rights Act, said its positive impact should be welcomed and protected. Edinburgh South West SNP MP Joanna Cherry QC, the committee's deputy chair, said she welcomed the report's publication. She told the National, "Now more than ever, against the background of the pandemic and the threats to rights such as freedom of expression and freedom of assembly implicit in the UK government's current legislative programme, the human rights and protections afforded by the Human Rights Act are very important." The HRA incorporates the European Convention on Human Rights, the ECHR, into the UK's domestic legal systems, and MPs and peers on the committee said it was essential that proposals to amend it take account of its unique role in the constitutional arrangements of the devolved nations. They concluded that the UK government should not pursue reform of the Act without the consent of the devolved parliaments in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. However, they said amending it could constitute a risk to the UK's constitutional settlement and to the enforcement of human rights across the UK. As a result of the Act, human rights cases are now heard first by judges in the UK's domestic courts. They're heard sooner and action is less prohibitively expensive. Judges from the UK's four nations are also able to take better account of the UK and national context of cases, which the report said had resulted in an improvement in the enforcement and accessibility of human rights in the UK. Public authorities had to act compatibly with ECHR rights, embedding them in the delivery of public services. The Act is also a central part of the devolution settlement. The government's review looked closely at the relationship between the UK courts and the ECHR and found that the Human Rights Act did not unduly constrain the domestic courts. It also considered that the requirement in Section 2 of the Act that UK courts take into account relevant factors, including ECHR judgments, was entirely sensible. Joanna Cherry said, "In Scotland, the HRA applies as an integral part of a larger and more complex legal and constitutional framework. The powers of the Scottish Parliament and the government are limited by the requirement to act compatibly with human rights obligations under the Scotland Act and under Section 29 of that Act legislation, which is incompatible with the rights in the ECHR defined by reference to the HRA. It's outside competence of the Scottish Parliament. Accordingly, I'm delighted that the cross-party committee has concluded that the UK government should not pursue reform of the HRA without the consent of the Scottish Parliament." By Greg Russell.
From the National, date Monday the 12th of July 2021, from the comment section, "Removing only the worst male offenders is often too late," by Kirsty Strickland, columnist. When Sarah Everard was murdered back in March, her death sparked a wave of protests, vigils and demands for action. Candles lit up on doorsteps across the UK and ribbons were tied to railings and lampposts. These were symbols of the grief and anger of women, not just for Sarah but for themselves too. Women, once again, spoke about their experiences of male violence and street harassment. They did so knowing, deep down, that nothing would change. For every high-profile case of a woman murdered by a man, there are countless other instances of male violence that, for a myriad of reasons, don't make the headlines. And so, when the spotlight does fall fleetingly upon the deadly consequences of misogyny and women's inequality of safety, women want to make their voices heard. Even when they know from bitter experience that not enough people are listening. This week, former police officer Wayne Cousins pled guilty to the abduction and murder of Sarah Everard. He will be sentenced in September, and the judge has warned that he could face a whole life term. Cousins deserves to spend the rest of his life in prison for his crimes. We can only hope that Sarah's family and friends will find some comfort from knowing that her murderer had been brought to justice. But locking up violent men after they have committed the most unspeakable acts doesn't fully address the wider issues raised by the Sarah Everard case. When women talk about street harassment and how they often don't feel safe in public spaces, it is treated as a low-level concern. It seems not to matter that all much of the women I have no way of knowing which man who follows them down a street or shouts at them from a car is just trying to be friendly, and which is not. When compared to murder, such fears are seen as trivial. But therein lies the problem. We shouldn't compare crimes against women in this way. They are linked. They are rooted in and stem from the same rotten place. Identifying and removing the very worst offenders after they've committed the very worst offences is often too late. We should see non-fatal offences as a red warning sign. We know the link between a man who chokes his partner and then later on goes to murder her. We know about the escalation of violence in abusive relationships and how a woman is most at risk when she tries to leave. And we know that the acceptance and normalisation of harassment in public spaces makes women feel unsafe. It's a poison that has a pervasive impact on how we as a society view violence against women and the priority we place on eradicating it. This week, we learned that key opportunities may have been missed in identifying Cousins as a sex offender while he was serving as a police officer. 6 years before Sarah's murder, Kent Police received a complaint about a man, thought to be Cousins, indecently exposing himself in a car. No arrests were made, and it has taken until now for that information to be revealed by the Independent Office for Police Conduct. The IOPC also confirmed that just days before he abducted and killed Sarah, Wayne Cousins was suspected of 2 other instances of indecent exposure. The director of the Centre for Women's Justice, Harriet Winstrich, has called for a public inquiry into police failures. She said, "Women do not feel safe, and it's incumbent on the government and all criminal justice agencies to now take action over the epidemic of male violence, which is the other public health crisis of our day." Commenting on the case, Labour's Jess Phillips made a key point about why it isn't enough to encourage women to report crimes against them. "This isn't just about women being confident. This is about getting perpetrators of sexual crimes and battery and murder off our streets." One of the reasons many women said that the Sarah Everard murder struck a chord with them was because she was just walking home. She had done everything women were told to do to keep themselves safe. She walked in a brightly lit area. She wore bright clothes. She phoned her boyfriend on the way. Women have, collectively, illustrated the scale of the problem. They have shared their stories of male violence. The statistics are there, in the hands of governments, and the police and the justice system. We know how much it costs us when people accept that violence against women is just an unfortunate fact of life. We know how few perpetrators are held accountable for their actions. We know that murder is rarely a violent man's first offence. And we know, sadly, that things are getting worse for women, not better. And that was an opinion piece by Kirsty Strickland.
This article is from The National, date 9th July 2021, from the Culture section. Bon Scott, AC/DC frontman's legacy lives on, by Martin Hannon. So, what's the story? If he had been spared, today would have been the 75th birthday of the legendary Bon Scott, lead singer and frontman of one of the world's greatest rock bands, AC/DC. Born on July 9th, 1946, at the Fife Jamieson Maternity Hospital in Forfar Angus, and raised in Kirriemuir, Ronald Belford Scott emigrated to Australia with his parents, Charles and Isabel, and younger brother Derek, at the age of 6. The family settled in the Melbourne suburb of Sunshine before moving 4 years later to Fremantle, Western Australia. It was while he was in Sunshine Primary School that he acquired the nickname Bon, because there was already a Ronald in the class and his classmates called him Bon after Bonnie Scotland. It stuck, and Bon Scott he remained. He wasn't really Scottish, was he? He most certainly was a Scot, and proud of it. One of the first things he did when moving to Fremantle was join the local Caledonian Scots Pipe Band, along with his dad, known as Chick, where Bon learned to play the drums. He would later learn to play the bagpipes, and sometimes featured them on recordings and in videos. Early in his career, he was being interviewed by a radio DJ who, for some reason, told his listeners Scott was from Liverpool. Scott interrupted him to say, "Kirriemuir, I'm from Kirriemuir," and then had to explain where Kirriemuir was. Scott had a patriotic tattoo, a lion rampant with Scotland Forever etched on his arm. He did lose nearly all trace of a Scottish accent and always credited Australia for the opportunities it gave him and his family, but always spoke proudly of his Scottish ancestry and birth. So tell us about his career. After dropping out of education at 15 and working in various jobs, Scott had a brush with the law, which saw him spend months in a young offenders institution, a spell that also cost him the chance of joining the Australian Army. While working as a postman and barman in Fremantle in 1964, he began his own band, the Spectres, which later merged with the Winstons to form the Valentines, which had some minor success before splitting in 1970. Moving to Adelaide, Scott joined the rock band Fraternity, who also had some successes, such as touring the UK as support to Status Quo. But the band stopped operating in 1973, and Scott had to find work in a fertiliser manufacturing plant by day and write music at night. Fortunately for Scott, in 1974, two other Sydney-based Scottish-born musicians were looking for a singer to front their band AC/DC, who specialised in a harder form of rock music. They've been classed as heavy metal and blues rockers, but the band always just say they play rock and roll. Malcolm and Angus Young were originally from Glasgow, and the three Scots bonded quickly, forming a songwriting team. Angus Young later recalled that Scott moulded the character of AC/DC. "Everything became more down to earth and straight ahead. That's when we became a band." The AC/DC sound had materialised and the timing could not have been better. They quickly became successful all over Australia and toured internationally, with some pundits even crediting them with being the founding influence of punk and new wave. Their first two albums, High Voltage and TNT, were critically well received and they began to gather international attention. They toured the UK and Europe, and during the tour to promote their album Powerage, they famously recorded a live track at the Glasgow Apollo in 1978. They had just made it big in the US with their sixth album, Highway to Hell, when tragedy struck. So how did he die? Married and divorced, Scott's use of drugs and alcohol developed over several years until, on the night of February 18th, 1980, the singer visited a London club and was left to sleep off his intoxication in the car of his friend Alistair Kinnear. The next morning, Scott was found dead in the car, the coroner recording a verdict of acute alcohol poisoning and death by misadventure. The debate still rages as to exactly how he died. While the Young Brothers wanted to disband, they were persuaded to hire Brian Johnson as his replacement. 5 months later, they released the momentous album Back in Black in tribute to Scott, and they duly went on to become one of the biggest bands in the world. That article was by Martin Hannan. This article is from The National, date 12th July 2021, from the Culture section. Memorial to victims of Irish famine to be revealed at church where Celtic founded. By Abby Garton Crosby. A memorial to the victims of the Irish famine is to be unveiled at the Catholic church where Celtic FC was founded. A 5 metre tall artwork named The Tower of Silence will be unveiled on July 25th this year at the front of St Mary's Church in Calton, Glasgow. The steel sculpture will feature emaciated figures to chart the story of the Irish immigrants who made new lives in Glasgow after the famine in the 19th century claimed the lives of around 1 million Irish. Previously, there have been tensions in the area during Orange Order marching season, which is predominantly in July. St Mary's Parish priest Canon Tom White was spat on and verbally abused in 2018 as an orange walk passed by Sister Church St Alphonsus in Trongate just after he had said Mass. And now some have claimed the move is provocative and could lead to further trouble. However, organisers of Angortamore Glasgow said the experience had been positive. The artwork, a collaboration between artist John McCarran and sculptor Maurice Harran, was brought to life by £80,000 in public donations. Sir Tom Devine, the historian, called the organisation's approach brazen and questioned whether the project was aimed at commemorating the tragedy of all families who were devastated by the tragedy and not just some. Speaking to the Times newspaper, he highlighted the unveiling in 2001 by Irish Taoiseach Bertie Ahern of a famine monument at the Carfin Grotto in Lanarkshire. There's also a memorial installed in Glasgow Green in 2018, dedicated to all those who died or suffered in the Irish and Highland famines. Devine said it was an explicitly inclusive commemoration of dreadful times and struck an emotional chord with people of all faiths and none. Now one organisation brazenly announces a plan to soon establish, unhistorically, the first memorial to the tragedy in the grounds of a Catholic church in Glasgow. Jeanette Finlay, organiser at Angortamore Glasgow, said some would regard as controversial anything that commemorates the plight of the Irish. But getting our community involved, raising money for the project, has been a positive experience for us. St Mary's was the site where Brother Walfred convened the first meeting of Celtic FC in 1888 as part of a charity intended to raise funds for the poor and provide a social outlet for the men. White told the Times that this made the church a fitting site as its history was intertwined with that of the Irish community in Scotland and that it would be hard for anyone to find controversy in the memorial. That article was by Abby Garton Crosby.
From The National, Tuesday the 13th of July 2021, from the news section. Holyrood can hold referendum on whatever it likes, Secret Whitehall email says, by Gregor Young. The Scottish Parliament can hold a referendum on whatever it likes, a previously secret UK government email has revealed. Released by the National Archives, the message came from Tony Blair's special advisor in Scotland, just hours before the Labour government published its devolution plans in 1997. In it, Pat McFadden said the then Scottish Secretary Donald Dewar took the view that the Scottish Parliament could have a referendum on whatever it likes, including matters outside its legislative competence. In an email to Blair's Chief of Staff, Jonathan Powell, on July the 22nd, 1997, McFadden said some Scottish MPs were very scared that such a referendum could take place and about the slippery slope to independence. Paisley-born McFadden, who is now a Labour MP, asked Blair's Chief of Staff, Jonathan Powell, to find out Blair's view on the issue as a matter of urgency. No replies included in the government archive release. The email, which does not carry the weight of a legal opinion or civil service advice to ministers, but is, nonetheless, intriguing, was written a year before Westminster passed the 1998 Scotland Act, which underpins devolution and paved the way for Holyrood. The debate over whether Holyrood can hold its own vote on independence remains contentious. Nicola Sturgeon, who wants another referendum by 2024, has said that if the Prime Minister continues to withhold the required powers, she will pass her own referendum bill at Holyrood, effectively daring him to challenge it at the UK Supreme Court. The 1998 Scotland Act gives Holyrood a general power to legislate, except in areas explicitly out of bounds. Schedule 5 states that the Union is one such area, solely reserved to Westminster. However, some legal scholars argue Holyrood could, nevertheless, hold a referendum to test public opinion on the Union, even if it couldn't legislate to change it. Some SNP MPs, including Joanna Cherry QC, also argue this is a credible position. It would seem to be given further credence by the newly released email, which says Holyrood can have referendums on anything it wants, even if it cannot enact the result. The issue has never been tested in court. Sturgeon has said the mutually agreed, legally watertight arrangement for the 2014 referendum remains the gold standard that should apply, but it's getting pushed by the Johnsons' blocking and impatience from inside the SNP to take a unilateral approach. It is the same issue which McFadden raised in his email 2 days before Dewar was due to publish the UK government's white paper on Scottish devolution. Copying in Blair's private secretary, as well as Powell, McFadden said weekend Scottish papers had contained some speculation over whether the Scottish Parliament would be able to hold a referendum on independence, what the SNP had dubbed a glass ceiling. McFadden said there was obviously a glass ceiling to a Scottish Parliament because its powers were limited and sovereignty stayed with Westminster. But leave that aside for the moment, he said. The issue was never discussed by DSWR, the Cabinet Committee on Devolution to Scotland, Wales and the English Regions. It is not referred to in the White Paper. The reserve powers model means that the Scottish Parliament will have the power to legislate on anything not in the reserve list. Therefore, it can have referendums on anything it wants, even if it cannot enact a result. There is a precedent in Scotland. Strathclyde Region's referendum on water privatisation a couple of years ago. 70% turnout, 97% opposed to privatisation. A couple of very worried Scottish MPs have rung me about this. It scares them a great deal that such a referendum could take place. They say the Nats will press and press for it, particularly when we are taking uncomfortable decisions. Donald's view is that the Scottish Parliament can have a referendum on whatever it likes, even matters outside its competence, which is in line with the logic of the White Paper. The only way to stop this would be to insert what would be called a glass ceiling, to put forward a measure in the Scotland Bill that the Scottish Parliament could only hold referendums on matters within its competence. The result would be a great row about limiting freedom of speech, but would be welcomed by our MPs, very worried about the slippery slope to independence. I think Donald would be opposed to such a measure, but other MPs certainly would not. There is an urgency about this matter because the question will be asked on Thursday, the White Paper's publication. It's already running in the papers. Can you find out Tony's view? As it turned out, the matter did not arise in the Commons that week, but did the following May, as the Scotland Bill was debated, and Dewar seemed to change his mind. He told MPs, "It is clear that constitutional change, the political bones of the parliamentary system and any alteration to that system is a reserved matter." That would obviously include any change or preparations for change. A referendum that purported to pave the way for something that was ultra vires is itself ultra vires. And that piece was by Gregor Young. From The National, Tuesday the 13th of July 2021, from the politics section, Scotland COVID level 0, what are the restrictions? By Kathleen Nutt, Chief Political Reporter. Nicola Sturgeon will today make a statement to MSPs outlining If coronavirus restrictions will be eased across Scotland later this month, following plans to move the country to the lowest curbs. An indicative date of Monday, July 19th had previously been put forward for the country to move to level zero, with further restrictions to move beyond level zero set to be relaxed on August the 9th. The First Minister said last Thursday she hoped the country could move to level zero, though some doubt was cast over whether her government would press ahead with the plans amid a recent spike in infections. Health Secretary Hamza Yousaf said on Sunday, Scotland is past the worst of the current peak and that positive trend was beginning to emerge in the data, despite daily cases still being high. Many parts of Scotland, including Glasgow, Edinburgh, Dundee and Stirling, are currently in level 2, while Highland, Argyll and Bute, Aberdeen and Aberdeenshire, Moray, Angus, Perth and Kinross, Falkirk, Fife, Inverclyde, East and West Lothian, West and Bartonshire, Dumfries and Galloway and the Borders are in level 1. Shetland, Orkney and the Western Isles are currently at level 0. The following are some of the main restrictions which apply to level 0. Meeting up with other people. Up to 8 people from 4 households can meet indoors and can stay overnight. Up to 10 people from 4 households can meet in an indoor public place like a cafe, pub or restaurant. Up to 15 people from 15 households outdoors. Weddings and funerals. Up to 200 people can attend weddings and funerals. You should work from home where possible. What can open up at level zero? Places and businesses that can open at level zero include cafes, pubs and restaurants, all shops and stores, all close contact services including hairdressers, barbers and beauty salons, all sport and exercise, tourist accommodation, all visitor attractions, all public buildings like libraries and community centres, all entertainment apart from nightclubs and adult entertainment, stadiums and events, with maximum numbers, a limited and phased return to offices. Outdoor seated and open space events are advised to operate with a maximum capacity of 2,000 people. Outdoor group standing events are advised to operate with a maximum capacity of 1,000 people. Seated indoor events are advised to operate with a maximum of 400 people. What must close at level zero? Places and businesses that must close at level zero include nightclubs and adult entertainment. Rules on the face mask wearing. It is compulsory to wear a face mask on level zero in shops, on public transport or in any crowded place. Their use is mandatory in restaurants, cafes, bars, banks and in workplaces. This is because transmission is most likely to occur when people are close to each other in crowded and poorly ventilated spaces. They also must be worn in health and social care settings. Advice to people who are shielding on level zero. The advice is to follow that given to the general population. And that piece was by Kathleen Nutt. From the National, Tuesday the 13th of July 2021, from the politics section. Tories appeal ruling to release secret polling on the union as deadline expires. By Kathleen Nutt, Chief Political Reporter. Michael Gove's union unit has refused to release secret polling on attitudes to the union following a legal order to make the information public. The move follows a tribunal ruling last month which gave the Cabinet Office 28 days to hand over the documents. Gove's department decided to appeal the decision last night as the deadline set by the panel expired. A UK government spokesman told The National, "We disagree with the tribunal's conclusions and have requested permission from the court to appeal. On that basis, the information has not been released." The Cabinet Office was dealt a major blow on June 14th after it was ordered to disclose the files following a Freedom of Information FOI request by SNP MP Tommy Shepherd in June 2019, seeking details it had carried out on polling since January 2018 on public perception on the union, including how much public money had been spent on it. It refused, citing an exemption clause which related to providing a safe space for the development of government policy. The National made a request to the Cabinet Office, run by Gove, on June 16th, 2 days after the ruling was sent to UK government officials. This paper asked to be given the document, but the department refused to do so, indicating it would respond to the ruling in due course. Shepherd appealed to the Office of the Information Commissioner, ICO, arguing that since the UK government had no stated intention to review or alter policy in respect of the union, the clause should not apply. The ICO sided with the government, and in February last year, Shepherd, the SNP MP for Edinburgh East, took the case to tribunal. In a victory for the SNP, the first-tier tribunal, General Regulatory Chamber, Information Rights, ruled the information requested relates to the implementation of existing policy rather than to policy development, and that the Cabinet Office must disclose it within 28 days. Polls on independence have varied over the last year, with support reaching 58%. The latest poll put it at 48%. Shepherd, who is his party's constitutional affairs spokesman at Westminster, accused the Cabinet Office last month of acting like a sore loser and said the polling survey should be made public immediately. "This is quite disgraceful. They're acting like sore losers," Shepherd said. "They should have the good grace to admit defeat and accept when the court tells them they are wrong. They may well be putting themselves in a position where they're in contempt of the court." He added, "They can appeal on the grounds of procedure, arguing that the tribunal didn't make its consideration properly in some way. They can't appeal on the substance. They should hand over the files right away and should not wait 28 days to do so. They should show humility and good grace." The ruling was the latest setback for Gove, who was slammed by a judge earlier this last month for a profound lack of transparency and was ordered to release internal files, shedding light on a secretive unit that handles freedom of information requests. The developments also follow a successful long-running freedom of information battle between the National and the Scotland Office in obtaining UK government files dating back to the planning of the devolution referendum in 1997. And that piece was an exclusive by Kathleen Nutt. From the National, Tuesday the 13th of July 2021, from the news section, Tyrone Mings, ex-Tory minister, agrees that Priti Patel stoked fires of racism, by Xander Richards, multimedia journalist. A former Tory minister in Boris Johnson's government has said that England player Tyrone Mings was completely right to say that Priti Patel had stoked the fire of racism. The extraordinary intervention from the football star came after Patel, the Home Secretary, tweeted to condemn the racist abuse suffered by black members of the England squad after their team lost to Italy in the Euro 2020 final. Patel wrote, "I am disgusted that England players who have given so much for our country this summer have been subject to vile racist abuse on social media. It has no place in our country, and I back the police to hold those responsible accountable." However, Patel said not 1 month previously that actions such as taking a knee were gesture politics. She said, "I just don't support people participating in that type of gesture." She also appeared to suggest that the impact of Black Lives Matter protests on the police had been devastating, and said booing those taking a knee against racism was a choice which she refused to condemn. Mings, who plays as a centre-back for Premier League club Aston Villa and the England national team, was one of the many public figures to highlight the hypocrisy of Patel's ultimate condemnation of the racists. In a tweet which has already been liked more than 400,000 times, Mings wrote, "You don't get to stoke the fire at the beginning of the tournament by labelling our anti-racism message as gesture politics and then pretend to be disgusted when the very thing we're campaigning against happens." Ming's intervention has made headlines across the UK, with one former Tory minister saying he was completely right. Johnny Mercer, who was fired as a defence minister before he could quit after accusing Boris Johnson of breaking a promise to veterans, wrote on Twitter, "The painful truth is that this guy is completely right. Very uncomfortable with the position we Conservatives are needlessly forcing ourselves into. Do I fight it or stay silent? Modern conservatism was always so much more to me. We must not lose our way." He added that he was very uncomfortable with some of my colleagues and their unnecessary interventions in what he termed a culture war. A further endorsement of Ming's message came from Labour Deputy Leader Angela Rayner, who wrote, "This, leaders on and off the pitch." A member of the FA's Inclusion Advisory Board also said Mings was right to be angry with Patel for failing to condemn booing of players taking the knee. Former footballer Marvin Sordo, who said racism was a big factor in his retirement from the sport, told BBC Radio 4's Today programme, "He has every right to be angry, just as I am, just as I'm sure millions of people are across this country as well. Because there was a massive opportunity to show strong leadership at that point. There was an opportunity then to really back the players in what they're trying to do, what they're trying to achieve, the positive message that they're trying to talk about, and yet that was dismissed, and people were allowed the opportunity to react negatively to something that was purely positive. However, some on the right tried to silence the young footballer, saying it is not his role to play politics." Niall Gardiner, a former aide to Margaret Thatcher, wrote, "England players should focus on qualifying for and winning the World Cup in 2022 instead of engaging in political attacks on democratically elected representatives of the British people, including the Home Secretary, who has dedicated her life to serving her nation." However, the massive outpouring of support for Mings for using his democratic right to express his views and fight back against racism far outweighs the voice he's trying to silence him. He is not the only England player to have hit out at the racists whose vile abuse came into the public eye after the Euro 2020 final. Marcus Rashford, whose mural was defaced with racist graffiti on Sunday night, also hit out, saying he would never apologise for who he is or where he comes from. Former England player Gary Neville also panned the Tory government, saying the racism suffered by the England team starts at the very top. And that piece was by Xander Richards.
From The National, Tuesday 13th of July 2021, Sport. Celtic dealt blow as target Matt Ryan completes Real Sociedad switch, by Mark Hendry. Matt Ryan has ended all speculation linking him to Celtic after completing a switch to Real Sociedad. The goalkeeper, 29, had been rumoured to be on the Hoops transfer radar this summer as Ange Postecoglou builds his squad for an assault on the Premiership. The former Brighton man, who spent last season on loan at Arsenal, had even hinted he would be willing to make the move to Glasgow. Just last week, he was asked whether he'd prefer paella or haggis on Fox Sports in Oz, to which he replied, "Haggis every day of the week. No, at the moment I'm on the fence. I'm not sure what I fancy, what my taste buds are craving just now. I'll have to wait and see. At the moment, just nothing. I'm just waiting and seeing, until I guess I get a bit of a craving to find out." But, confirming his move last night, La Liga outfit Real Sociedad shared a short clip of their new man. "I will work hard and I can't wait to get started playing with the team," the stopper said. Meanwhile, at Celtic, Vasilis Barkas reportedly will not be heading out on loan as Champions League qualifiers against FC Midtjylland approach. He had been linked with a return to AEK Athens. That article was by Mark Hendry. From the National, 13th of July 2021, Sport. Glasgow Clan appoint experienced Canadian Malcolm Cameron as new coach. Glasgow Clan have appointed a new coach in experienced Canadian Malcolm Cameron. The Canadian fills the role, which was vacated in April 2020, previously held by Zach Fitzgerald, weeks after the coronavirus shutdown. And Gareth Chalmers, the Clan's chief operating officer, says his previous experience was key to the decision, revealing there was sizeable interest in the role. "We've spent a considerable amount of time looking at almost 30 different candidates for the role," Chalmers said. "With the anticipated exciting new developments at the club, it was imperative we were able to appoint someone who would bring head coaching experience, as well as having carried out a previous hockey operations role off the ice. His coaching experience and record was obviously key in the decision-making. However, his invaluable recruiting experience, extensive contacts and connection to Scotland were fundamental in the decision-making process." After interviewing a number of candidates, all with very impressive backgrounds and experience, we felt Malcolm was the best person for the position. "Malcolm is extremely excited to be coming to Scotland and joining the Clan, and we're looking forward to welcoming him to Glasgow for an exciting new period for everyone associated with the club." The club are still in the midst of negotiation with asset management firm Global Mutual after the operation of Braehead Arena following the collapse of Into last year. Clan have teased there have been positive discussions, but full details have yet to be disclosed about the detail of how they'll take over the venue, which has been their home since 2010. It's the first real sign they are on the verge of returning, between the uncertainty over their home and the coronavirus pandemic, which led to the league shutting down in March 2020. For Cameron, who has Scottish ancestry, he joins from Romania side Giurgioi, where he coached until earlier this year, and is the fifth highest in games coached and wins in the East Coast Hockey League. That article was by Craig Anderson. From the National, Tuesday, 13th July 2021, from the sports section. Kilmarnock face SPFL punishment for fielding suspended players in cup win over East Kilbride, by Mark Hendry. Kilmarnock face a disciplinary hearing after including an ineligible player in their squad for last weekend's win over East Kilbride. Killy welcomed Daniel Armstrong into their matchday list of players during their trip to Kay Park for their Premier Sports Cup clash on Saturday. But now it has been revealed the 23-year-old had been subject of a one-match suspension in the competition. The SPFL have confirmed they will investigate the Rugby Park outfit's mistake and take action. Armstrong played just under 20 minutes of the game, having come on in the 72nd minute of Killy's 2-0 win in Group G. A disciplinary hearing has been set up for July the 15th. That article was by Mark Hendry.
Recorded from the National on the 13th of July 2021. From the Culture section, Jane Godley to release first fiction novel after signing with Publishing House, by Laura Webster. Scottish comedian Jane Godley is set to put out her first fiction novel after signing with a publishing house. Godley, whose Nicola Sturgeon voiceover videos regularly go viral, said she had spent the last year in lockdown working on the book as her favourite project. "All she has left to do is find a title," she told Twitter followers. The comedian has signed with London-based Hodder & Stoughton to release the novel. Godley has previously published two books, Handstands in the Dark, an inspirational memoir about her experience growing up in Glasgow, first released in 2005, and Frank Get the Door, My Feet Are Killing Me, which includes transcriptions of her popular voiceovers. Featuring illustrations by Christina Conley, the book released last year charts Scotland's journey through the pandemic. That article was by Laura Webster. Recorded from the National on the 13th of July 2021. From the Culture section. Scottish Art Festival to take to the world stage for the first time, by Nansport. Scotland's largest rural performing arts festival has an international platform this year for the first time. combining an outdoor travelling stage, pop-up performances in unexpected locations, and a digital programme packed with world-class artists, Dumfries and Galloway Arts Festival is returning in a new format for over 10 days this July. Starting on Friday the 16th, there are 60 events blending music, theatre, dance, comedy and spoken word. New director Melanie Purdy told the Sunday National the festival would mark the start of the highly anticipated return to theatre gigs and shows following the coronavirus lockdowns. Purdy said the festival, which had to be cancelled last year because of the pandemic, was a vital component of the country's art calendar each year. Being able to return with an offering of both live performances in a safe environment and a digital programme for audiences to watch in the comfort of their own home is a great balance, she said. It's new for us and comes with its own challenges, but our small, strong and dedicated team are working hard to deliver the best experiences. She added it was incredibly exciting and adventurous to take on the leadership as society begins to reopen. It's a time to experiment, rip up the rulebook and develop new ideas, strands and models to engage audiences, said Purdy. This year's theme is Hamel Dami, which she said was a tribute to the burgeoning artists and world-class performers of the region and a celebration of its diverse culture. The programme includes a live stand-up set from comedian Mark Nelson and a new album showcase from Smith & McLennan, a celebration of European music from the Friarlight Trio, and a sneak peek into the world of emerging five-piece band The Lucky Doves. The musical side of the programme features the Scottish Ensemble in a live online performance combining their trademark music for strings with reflections on how music can be used by people to feel better. And uninvited guests and Fuel will present love letters at home, a night of song dedications and the stories attached to them with declarations of love past and present. In theatre, following a successful virtual tour of Scotland last month, Helen Milne Productions' Distance Remaining will share the story of three lost souls making a break for freedom during the first lockdown, and Vanishing Point and Bright Theatre will present Deliverance, a show delivered straight to people's doors. Buskers and Fox and Hound, in association with Annan Harbour, will stage Lot 52 and Sea Shanties, a new play directed by award-winning Ken Gouge, which follows the story of a family leaving Annan Harbour in 1775 to sail to Nova Scotia in search of a better life. It is described as a story of resilience and fortitude that resonates with modern-day mass immigration. In addition, Townsend Theatre Productions will perform The Ragged Trousered Philanthropists, an enduring and entertaining classic story of Edwardian painters and decorators by Robert Tressel, which tells of their struggle for survival. Meanwhile, Caroline Yates will stage Gaze, a creative response to photographer Kim Eyre's nude portraits of women over 50. In partnership with local theatre company Townsend Theatre Productions, the Talking Horse's mobile outdoor venue will tour through the heart of Dumfries and Galloway, hosting artists from each community on its travelling stage. Each event day will present four live performances. For the full programme, visit dgartsfestival.org.uk. And that article was by Nansport.
From the National, date Wednesday the 14th of July 2021, from the comment section, Alan Smith, smaller, meaner, cheaper, this is the UK the Tories want. By Alan Smith, columnist. International development is close to Scotland's heart. My inbox is regularly full of messages from people wanting to see us engage with some of the poorest in the world, not just out of charity, but because it is the right thing to do. If the pandemic has taught us anything, it is that we're all interconnected. The Tory government had to be dragged kicking and screaming to give Westminster the right to decide yesterday whether it should approve cuts to international aid. It had hoped to push it through without even a vote. Even when it did agree to one, it gave MPs less than 24 hours to prepare for the debate. We lost 333 to 298, a rebellion, but not a huge one. The argument the Tory government used to justify its decision to cut foreign aid was that Parliament must decide between fiscal responsibility or human responsibility. It said there is no money to help the world's poorest, It said COVID has changed the game. It has said nothing of substance because it knows its actions are morally reprehensible, irresponsible and dangerous. We in the SNP have condemned the aid cuts from the very beginning, as have the Liberal Democrats, Labour and, to their credit, some Tory MPs. In my constituency of Stirling, 98.2% of total votes cast went to parties committed to spending 0.7% of gross national income, GNI, or international aid. Tories, Labour, SNP, Lib Dems, Greens all made a commitment, but only the Tories have broken their promise. Despite this, they want us to believe they will be increasing foreign aid when the fiscal situation allows it. Yet their criteria has only been met once in the past 20 years. Be of no doubt, I believe this is a sinister attempt to balance the books on the backs of the world's poorest. There is nothing fiscally responsible about this Tory government. It is increasingly investing in nuclear weapons, handing out NHS contracts to the Tory chums, and splashing out on a £200 million royal yacht for what exactly? To sail up the Nile and deliver aid like some mercy ship? No. It shall only be a galling reminder that while the world needed humanitarian aid the most, the UK could only contribute empty words to feed empty stomachs. Of course, that's all assuming this government will keep its word. We all remember how Mr. Johnson promised there would be no hard border in the Irish Sea, then put one there anyway. We all remember how he promised Brexit would be a titanic success, only for trade with our closest neighbours to plummet. In Scotland, we want our taxes to be spent on something worthwhile. Scotland is an internationalist country with a humanitarian conscience. We want to emulate our closest neighbours in the EU and our friends across the pond who have increased international aid spending during this pandemic. There is something to be said about the fact that while the UK is cutting its aid to 0.5% of GNI, the SNP Scottish Government is increasing international aid spending by 50%. Imagine how much more an independent Scotland could do to tackle poverty both at home and abroad. Instead, we remain tied to an immoral and irresponsible Tory government and the only G7 country to cut international aid. Jacob Rees-Mogg, in his statement to the Commons on Monday, announcing that the debate would take place on the cuts, said, "Votes have consequences, and if the motion were to be negative, that would be a significant consequence for our fiscal situation." He is right. Votes do have consequences, and cutting foreign aid has health, security and economic consequences. The savings from the cuts are tiny, but their impacts are global. Yemen will see its aid cut by 60%, even though more than 22 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance. WASH, hygiene and sanitation programmes will have their funding cut by 80%, despite being a key defence in the fight against coronavirus. This Tory government claims the cuts will save the British taxpayer. It ignores the reality that 100,000 children will die as a result, their lives cut short to save pennies. We are only an island in a geographic sense. The impact of foreign aid cuts will come back to bite us. Our soft power reputation has taken a hit that will take decades to recover from. Our betrayal of others will be long remembered whenever we ask for international support. Our geopolitical rivals will come in to fill the gap that we leave behind. And where human actors fail to fill the gap, death, famine and plague will do their job more effectively. The UK remains a major donor of aid, of course, but this is still a broken promise to the world's poorest, at the worst time abandoning responsibility to international security, health and prosperity. But then, this is what this government wanted all along. Despite all the breathless rhetoric of global Britain, the reality is a smaller, cheaper, meaner little country, ill at ease when faced with the reality of its place in the world. Scotland can do so much better. We already have a well of talented international development experts in and around East Kilbride. There's a talent pool to recruit for Scotland's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And that was a comment piece by Alan Smith. From The National, Wednesday the 14th of July 2021, from the comment section, open letter to Gareth Southgate about memories of the war motivating his team, by Ewan Hunter. Dear Gareth Southgate, I admire much of what you have done and said. As England manager, you have taken a team of talented players and achieved some excellent results. Whether they're as talented as the media in England would have everyone believe is an entirely different matter. As someone who works with organisations across the UK and the world, with a particular focus on how to improve team working and performance, and as a fellow professional sportsman myself, I was also delighted to read about your apparently open-minded approach to the development of the right attitudes, the right mentality, and the right approach, all of which should and does lead to better performance. I particularly liked the fact you seem to embrace the well-founded notion of listening to dissenting voices rather than just the usual football echo chamber. In the world of psychology and in business, there is much to prove that such an approach works. I hope people in similar positions closer to home to me in Scotland are listening too. You felt moved to pen an open letter to some sections of your own fanbase who you believe were not clear about the fact that you, rightly, have no truck with those keen to hurl abuse, racial or otherwise. You spoke about a special group, humble, proud and liberated in being their true selves. I, and the vast majority of the thinking world, applauded you as you made it crystal clear your opposition to racism and abuse in all its forms, particularly on social media. In that open letter, you also referred to your own background, a topic I've heard you mention before, and on something I think where you and I may have some shared perspective. You spoke about the impact of your granddad in your life and your perspective. You mentioned that he fought in the Second World War and how those values have transcended the generations and are as strong with you as they were for him. My granddad also fought in the war, hardly a surprise as you and I are very close in age. My granddad was born into a humble mining family in Fife, and he fought in many places, notably in Tunisia, and he also then took part in the Anzio landings in Italy. He watched in horror as a German messenger who was shot. The fact his message never arrived actually alerted the German army to the possible Allied invasion. Had his stuff searched. Out fell a picture of this young guy with his wife and two children. My granddad said to his colleagues, "You do realise we're all the same. He doesn't want to be here any more than we do." Soon after that, my granddad was captured and spent the remainder of the war in two prisoner of war camps in Germany. He survived, fortunately. But what he fought for was democracy and freedom. Democracy and freedom for every thinking, caring member of humanity, whether it's Scotland, England, Wales, Germany, France, Italy, Russia, the USA, or anywhere else in the world. He fought against tyranny and the kind of idiotic, destructive approach of a tiny cabal of powerful people with only the most extreme right-wing politics and their own gains as motivations. When we see the actions of senior members of the current UK government in supporting those who abuse your players over taking the knee, and the reason for your open letter, then I'm not so certain that such views have been left behind in the 1940s. It's a very sad and worrying state of affairs. Imagine my dismay then when I saw you quoted in the Telegraph on Saturday, the day before the European Championship final. The European Championship final, what a wonderful occasion awaiting you and your team. All the hard work and years of practice have led you to that moment. Quite reasonably, you took the opportunity to open up a little and tell people what it all meant to you. Some of the inside take for such a showcase. a real gem for all England fans in particular, and certainly interesting to those of us who love our sport. The piece talked of how you wanted to emphasise the historic nature of the match, especially in this COVID-dominated world. You reportedly wanted to invoke the courage of the wartime generation. This is where my ears pricked up. You said, "I think there are historic things that we should be proud of. There are different aspects to it, but at heart, I go back to the values that my parents gave me, and treating people as you would want to be treated, and just respectful, really." The article reported you as having said that the country should not be ashamed to draw on past triumphs, and that you admitted the memories of the war has played a part in the defeat of Germany earlier in the tournament. You went on to say, "But also people have tried to invade us, and we've had the courage to hold them back. You can't hide that sort of energy in the stadium against Germany, but it's because of that. For an island our size, we've got an incredible influence in the world, and we've got to keep that in a positive way." As you would be the first to point out, you're England's football manager. But much as it may come as a surprise to some, England is not only the only nation on this island. Scotland and Wales have very long histories, as I'm sure you're aware. And in case of Scotland, when we signed the Union Treaty in 1707, the nation of Scotland has never gone anywhere. The Second World War was also won by the Allies, Great Britain, not England, USA, the Soviet Union, France and China, as well as all the wartime signatories to the original United Nations Declaration. That you spoke of invoking the courage of past triumphs and using the war as a factor in motivating you, as England, to win against Germany, made me say, "How dare you?" My granddad and millions like him fought for freedom. They fought against precisely the kind of idiotic, right-wing, unthinking, but not undeliberate behaviour as displayed by the racists you want to stand against. They fought for those things across all international boundaries. The Second World War was not nation pitted against nation like a football match. You cannot, on the one hand, complain loudly about some boorish, abusive elements within your own support, and simultaneously then talk about the war as though it was some kind of England versus Germany fight. To even infer that is deeply offensive to millions across the world. To do so also inflames the feelings, in a bad way, of precisely the kind of people you say you don't agree with. I'm going to assume that you didn't mean that, but I also feel duty-bound to highlight the hypocrisy of that position. You either don't know that England is not Great Britain, or that the Second World War was a fight for freedom and expression and democracy. Or you do, but didn't think about the logical consequence of your comments. I believe your comments were ill-considered, but as they were also deeply personal, I just leave you with one question. What would your granddad have truly said about this? I know what mine would have. I also believe you to be a very decent human being, so I wish you well in your continued journey of discovery, learning and development, and I hope that the disappointment of losing to an outstanding Italy side hasn't dented you from continuing the excellent work you have done thus far. All the best, Ewan Hunter. And that was a comment piece by Ewan Hunter. From the National, Wednesday the 14th of July 2021, from the comment section, our mock-up of Mancini as Braveheart was a success, despite the outrage by the Joker, Troublemaker. As if sat on his front page of the National needed defending, the eagle eye of Andrew Angus on Twitter left us fully vindicated, regardless, after he spotted during a cup of the Italy celebrations on their flight home that their victorious manager, Roberto Mancini, was sitting with a copy of the paper next to him, the European Championship trophy nestled on top. Going by the reaction the front page received on Friday night into Saturday morning, you might be forgiven for thinking Mancini has thereby bought into vile anti-Englishness. I would love to have seen the smile raise one corner of the big man's face, a manning jacket over his shoulder, perched on one finger, after strolling into W. H. Smith and spotting the National on the newsstand. There was less joy to be had elsewhere. One Twitter user went as far as to claim we were beyond embarrassment and bordering in fascism. Yes, fascism. A columnist in another Scottish newspaper labelled our front page abominable and suggested Scots supporting Denmark in the semi-final, then Italy in the final, were bordering in bigotry. There is a good reason why Mel Gibson's incarnation of William Wallace was chosen as the image to be photoshopped, and it's nothing to do with bigotry or fascism or Star Wars or raising the spirits of those who murdered the invading English. Braveheart is known internationally. That's it. That's the main reason. As much as we can all dislike and criticise and roll our eyes at stereotypes, they exist, and many a Scot around my age and older will remember a time when foreign trips inevitably led to freedom being screamed at you multiple times. That, coupled with the fact that it has been the National's thing to put out front pages which grab attention. The one with nothing but a silhouette of the then Prime Minister Theresa May and headline in here, after we were denied access to her Scottish press event, is a case in point. Those two elements are how Saturday's front page came about. People picking it apart and exposing its logical flaws have, like Marcus Rashford, overthought it and ultimately missed the target. The final ingredient in our front page was sporting rivalry, and any jibes at our anti-Englishness over the past week have been nothing but that. That's as far as the anti-Englishness goes. If anyone can point to any evidence where the front page goes beyond that, we'd like to hear it. You try being a Scot and listening to Sam Matterface treat his commentary booth like a mini fan zone during an England semi-final victory, or watching yet another rerun of a Euro 96 match, a tournament they didn't even win, when it's half-time in a game of the tournament between France and Switzerland, or 5 minutes before Ukraine and North Macedonia. You try all that and then try supporting what is, I have to admit, a very formidable and thoroughly likeable England team at a major tournament. Wishing that your rival loses is a big part of football, club and international. Wanting England to lose every tournament match they play no more makes me a bigot than me wanting Hibs to lose every Scottish Cup match. Claims or suggestions that the Sunday National had backpedalled due to the reaction were also wide of the mark. The Sunday edition has its own voice, and pieces are commissioned and often written well before the paper is printed on a Saturday and on the shelves on a Sunday. Gerry Hassan wrote his excellent piece because that was an interesting narrative of the England team at Euro 2020. In contrast, the front page on Saturday didn't have one single word written about it on the inside, far less a corresponding article linked to it. It was a front page that was a bit of fun ahead of a major sporting event that had gripped the attention of people from across the entire continent. The two things aren't comparable. In the early days of the National, the sometimes wacky front pages were our way of standing out in a crowded newsstand as an up-and-comer. And while we have on the whole moved away from that approach, it is revived now and then to great success. And that's the thing, Saturday's front page was a success. It changed the conversation the day before the biggest sporting event for England in a generation, much in the way the May silhouette cover changed the conversation about her visit. The next day, no one was talking about what May had said, but about our front page and why we were denied access. Saturday's front page, likewise, went viral and was the fuel of outrage for many a radio phone-in and panel show. That's on top of Mancini and Italy captain Giorgio Chiellini both been asked about it ahead of Sunday's match, and Mancini being spotted with a souvenir copy on his way home with the biggest prize in European international football. The excellent work of Damien Shields and Callum Baird should be celebrated. We could even take some credit for inspiring the Italians to victory. And that piece is by the Joker. From the National, Wednesday the 14th of July 2021, from the comment section. This is a stark truth about Scotland's coronavirus death toll. By Tasmina Ahmed Sheikh, columnist. During lockdown one last year, I arranged a television interview with New Zealand's top epidemiologist and public health professor, Michael Baker. At that point, Professor Baker argued it should have been possible for Scotland, and indeed the UK, to follow New Zealand in a COVID elimination strategy. Professor Baker explained he was a huge admirer of the public health tradition of these islands. Now, a year later, his tone is entirely different. Admiration has been replaced by bemused frustration, touching on contempt. He says, "By every metric, New Zealand's elimination approach is outperforming the alternatives. From a public health point of view, an equity point of view, a freedoms point of view, an economic point of view." Baker goes on to explain that the public health professionals are disturbed by the UK's return to allowing COVID to circulate unchecked, and that the phrase "living with it" was a meaningless slogan that failed to communicate the consequences of millions of infections or the alternative options for managing the virus. We often absorb a lot of our rhetoric from Europe and North America, which have really managed the pandemic very badly, Baker says. I don't think we should necessarily follow or accept Boris Johnson and co. saying, "Oh, we have to learn to live with the virus." We always have to be a bit sceptical about learning lessons from countries that have failed very badly. It is sometimes difficult to accept home truths from abroad. However, in this case, we would do well to listen, even now when it is much later than we think, but not too late to save sanity and lives. The latest idiocy of Freedom Day from Downing Street risks the serialisation of tragedy. The bodies may not be piled high, but they will be high enough. What is certain is an overflow of unnecessary human suffering as a semi-vaccinated UK takes the virus in the chin, to quote another of Johnson's vacuous verbal banalities. That is the grim reality behind the blithe UK government acceptance that cases could rise to 100,000 a day, soaring past the previous second wave record of 80,000. Even with a vaccine-protected population, this translates into thousands of hospitalisations each week. And behind even that dramatic figure lie the countless thousands more who will be laid low by long COVID. That is the level of expected sickness in Johnson's Britain. And, unfortunately, we have nothing to be proud of in Scotland. Last year, at least the presentation, if not always the substance, of our response was better than England. This year we have toddled on behind every Downing Street idiocy, lockstepped into the Four Nations Road to Perdition. As a result, we now have one in every 100 Scots currently infected. Yesterday's statement on relaxation is a case in point. It was presented as a cautious approach, somehow distinct from the English gung-ho. It is nothing of the kind. Johnson's conduct is outright insanity. Ours is just mad. The one remaining substantive difference between the English and Scottish approaches is that Nicola Sturgeon is telling us to wear masks, where Boris Johnson is asking them to be worn. These are the hard facts that have led to our current reduced circumstances. Scotland kept schools open even after the exams and allowed the virus to sweep through an unvaccinated school population. Our once lauded vaccination programme is stumbling, with panicked appeals for potential customers to attend virtually empty walk-in centres. Meanwhile, Test and Protect is near collapse as half the country's pinged its close contacts, with the resultant staff chaos and essential services of enforced self-isolation. Even the communication of the message, once the saving grace of the Scottish response, now looks uncertain. Why are we relaxing at all when the virus is still raging? Why are people being told to stay outdoors while pubs and restaurants have been reopened? Why does the instruction remain to avoid crowded spaces when we can switch on the television and see crowded sporting fixtures aplenty? I believe that there is now hardly a single person in the country, including the omnipresent Jason Leach, who clearly understands, according to the latest edicts, exactly how many households are allowed to gather at whatever settings, with or without counting children, before or after midnight, booked or unbooked. The message has become totally confused and completely ineffectual. Meanwhile, England's real tragedy from Sunday will not be losing a football match in penalties, but the inevitable coming of penalty of more than 60,000 people packed into Wembley, raucously roared on by countless more in crowded pubs and clubs around the country. Mark my words, the barbell for this lunacy will be in human misery. Laughably, the Foreign Office advice to potential UK visitors to New Zealand is to be aware of rapidly changing weather conditions and potential terrorism. They needn't worry. New Zealand is already preparing to put the UK in a no-fly list. New Zealand is roughly the same size as Scotland. They have had 26 fatalities from COVID. In Scotland, our death toll is more like 10,000. There is now no need to say anything else. And that was a comment piece by Tasmina Ahmed Sheikh. From The National, Wednesday the 14th of July 2021. From the comment section, this is why The National knocked it out of the park with that front page. Article by Kevin McKenna, columnist. When a newspaper manages to become part of the hoopla surrounding a major international event, it's entitled to consider it a job well done. The National's front page last week, on the eve of England's epoch-defining European Championship final against Italy, did this and then some. It breached into the pre-match build-up, knocking aside some of England's storied newspaper titles as it did so. What the Times or the Mail or the Telegraph wouldn't have given for the coach and the team captain of Italy or England to have spent some time discussing the aesthetics of their publication's front page at the big pre-match press conference. These papers had waited 55 years for this moment to arrive, and when it did, the UK's only pro-Scottish independent daily comes along and wrecks the joint. My first response in seeing The National's Robert Mancini Braveheart poster front page was to cheer. This is what you live for in newspapers, that your title provokes a public reaction from the main players in the year's major cultural drama. A much-loved former professor of journalism and a grizzled veteran of the trade himself, always opened his courses with this abiding truth about the print game. The principal aim of all newspapers is to sell more copies of their title than their rivals, he told us. It's lovely to hold public figures to account and to provide learned analysis of the day's big events, but what's the point if that's no one's buying the paper? Since its founding in 2015, The National has bucked up the UK-wide trend of declining newspaper sales. With more than 12,000 digital subscriptions alone, and climbing, it's now firmly established in Scotland's media firmament across every publishing platform. And a lot of other people read last Sunday's National, including about half of Italy. Among them was the Italian national football team boss, Roberto Mancini, who was pictured with the paper beside him, along with the beautiful old European Championship trophy, which his side had just won the previous night against England. The other main purpose of a newspaper is to provoke a response. Any front page that leaves no room for neutrality or indifference has succeeded. Everyone who saw her Mancini Braveheart front last week was either tickled by it or enraged by it. Predictably, many of those who laboured to be offended by it entirely missed the point. These people lamented the anyone but England attitude they felt it transmitted. Several commentators spoke of their disgust at such immature small-mindedness. The most comically po-faced amongst them worked themselves up into a real old lather. The National's front page pointed to something depressing in the Scottish psyche, they told us. They marvelled that they could even write such unadulterated drivel from their darkened rooms as they were enduring the dark night of their Scottish souls. Bless them. Calm down, chaps. It was only a cheeky newspaper front page. Let me guide you through it once more. But first, go and make yourself a nice cup of tea and maybe have a wee biscuit so you're ready for this. Here are the offending words. Save us, Roberto, you're our final hope. We can't take another 55 years of them banging on about this. Of course, this poked fun at the way that the English media waste no opportunity to remind the rest of the UK that England won the World Cup in 1966 and that football's coming home. They persistently ignored the fact that England's international football teams are the biggest underachievers since a hare was beaten by the tortoise at the Greek Animal Olympics in 624 BC. But our front page also lampooned Scotland. It caricatured the Braveheart spirit. We fail so badly and so often in these tournaments that it is all we have left to have a bit of fun at the expense of our much bigger, much more successful and far better dressed southern neighbours. It's nothing to do with independence or insecurity. It's not because of unresolved dad issues locking in our subconscious. It's because we're absolutely shite at this level and England are really rather good right now. And it's because their chief propagandists are fairly ridiculous in their sense of entitlement. Ask any Rangers fan about people like me banging on about Celtic's 1967 European Cup victory, as I've now just done again for about the 10,000th time. Those among Scotland's commentariat who labour to affect formulate disdain for the National Front page know nothing of football and football culture. They would tremble and fret at the prospect of attending an actual game. At some point in their newspaper journeys, they decided to ditch the desire to challenge power and now lived to be weekend Hemingways at dinner parties in Hindland, Strathmungo and the New Town. Here they all decide what they consider to be beneath their approximation of what cool and progressive Scotland should look like. And it certainly doesn't look like a front page mock-up of Roberto Mancini as Mel Gibson and as William Wallace in a contrived Hollywood epic. Others are so obsessive in their desire to attach anything negative about Scottish independence that they use microscopes to inspect every sentence and nuance for signs of beastliness. There is a lot of this evident in responses to the National's front page. There's actually a lot to like about the England international side in 2021 on both sporting and human levels. I watched the Copa America final between Brazil and Argentina on Saturday, and I've never seen both these great footballing nations look so poor at the same time. And while all of England's major European rivals, including Italy, are beginning to age, England, with seven players still eligible to play for the under-21s, have the makings of a team that could win the World Cup next year. At the age of 23, Marcus Rashford is facing down the evil of racism and winning. England should be proud of him. Hell, Scotland's proud of him. And that's because this is much more important than an international football tournament and all the daft geopolitical rivalries that accompany it. So, I hope the National's art department is already working up a few similar options for next year in Qatar. Maybe it could do Robert Mancini as Peter O'Toole playing Lawrence of Arabia with a big saltire on his cloak as he's roaming around that desert on his camel. Maybe not. And that was an opinion piece by Kevin McKenna.
Wednesday, the 14th of July, 2021, the National Sports Section. Tyrone Mings, Andrew Rosendale, hypocrite for attack on England player. A Tory MP has been slammed for hypocrisy after he told England football player Tyrone Mings to focus on football, not politics, despite previously backing a footballer who supported Brexit. Andrew Rosendale, MP, faced widespread backlash after he replied to a tweet from the football player hitting back at Home Secretary Preeta Patel. Mings told Patel, "You don't get to stoke the fire at the beginning of the tournament by labelling our anti-racism message as gesture politics and then pretend to be disgusted when the very thing we're campaigning against happens." Patel had previously refused to criticise fans who booed the team for taking the knee in protest against racial injustice. After England lost to Italy in the Euro 2020 final, there has been a torrent of racist abuse directed at England players Marcus Rashford, Jadon Sancho and Bukayo Saka. Rosendale replied to Mings' tweet saying, "We are all proud of our England team, who have had the support of the whole country over recent weeks. But please focus on football, not politics. If you win for England, you win for everyone." But Twitter users were quick to point out that the Tory MP had previously praised another England footballer, Sol Campbell, for backing Brexit. In 2016, Rosendale tweeted, "Glad to hear football legend Sol Man Campbell is backing at Vote Leave on June 23rd, hashtag Brexit." Meanwhile, SNP MP David Linden pointed out on Twitter that Scottish Tory leader Douglas Ross is an assistant referee. He said, "Hey, at Andrew Rosendale, why is it okay for at Douglas 4 Murray to focus on football and politics, but not at official TM underscore 3 Tyrone Mings?" Wednesday, the 14th of July, 2021, the National Sports Section. Celtic fans must be patient while Ange Postecoglou gets to grips with hoops, says Martin O'Neill. Former Celtic manager Martin O'Neill has told supporters to be patient as Greek-Australian Ange Postecoglou gets to grips with the demands of the Parkhead side. Celtic are looking to wrestle their title back off of Rangers after limply losing the league title last term. O'Neill, the Celtic manager, to be charged with overhauling a deficit that stretched to more than 20 points, believes the games against the Ibrox side will be crucial this season, but also believes that the 25-point chasm that separated the sides is not reflective of the gap between the squads. "I don't think the gap is as massive as it was in my time," said O'Neill, "only because I don't believe that Rangers have the calibre of player that they did. It's different generations that you are comparing, but I don't think that the Rangers team of today can compare with that Rangers side of the beginning of the century. But give the man a chance. I notice the players he had have all spoken highly of him, which is good." O'Neill's first task as Celtic manager was to replace Mark Viduka, who told him via a long-distance call from Australia that he wouldn't be returning to Glasgow. And the Irishman has warned that any players who aren't fully committed to the club need to go before a proper restructure can take place. "Some players will leave, and they better. If you don't want to play anymore for Celtic, then out you go," he said. "The start of the season will be vital, as it was for me. I count the first victory against Dundee United and the Hearts game at Tynecastle before the Rangers 6-2 game as vitally important for my own position. Had we dropped points before then, maybe the season takes a different outlook. Who knows?" "I think he would give anything for a win over Rangers just to stabilise things. The situation is not going to be easy." What O'Neill would love to see at Ibrox, however, is not just the supporting cast of supporters who contribute so much to the occasions, but also a return to the traditional allocation of tickets. In 2018, Rangers cut the Celtic allocation of tickets to just 800, with the Parkhead side doing likewise the following year. Both clubs cited demand from season ticket holders as a reason for the move, but O'Neill believes it has created a dilution in atmosphere. The Celtic fans are coming back, and you know what the Celtic fans can do, he said. They can be behind you and give you something you feel you didn't have, and like every set of fans, they can be a bit volatile. It would be great if both sets of fans in the respective numbers were allowed back into the opposition stadium, because there is nothing like it. There is nothing like 60,000 or 70,000 Rangers fans behind that goal, adding to the atmosphere, and the same with Celtic behind the goal at Ibrox. That would be lovely. Wednesday, the 14th of July, 2021, the National Sports Section. Celtic target Liel Abada's dad, joy at imminent Parkhead move after last-minute Dynamo Kiev burn. Incoming Celtic starlet Liel Abada's dad revealed he's delighted his son is set to sign for the Hoops after a nightmare last-minute collapse of a move to Dynamo Kiev earlier this year. Ange Postecoglou looks set to complete the signing of the Israeli international Abada for $3.5 million from homeland club Maccabi Petah Tikva. The 19-year-old striker will leave Israeli football after previously being on the brink of joining Ukrainian champions Kiev in January. Abada had agreed to move and reached an agreement on his salary, but was dismayed to read the small print on the contract. Any breach in the contract would have meant he would have lost 80% of his wages, and he had to sign a clause that meant he would not agree to take any possible dispute to FIFA or UEFA. At the very last minute, Abada pulled out of the deal and is now set to move to Glasgow, much to the relief of his father, Ronan. He said, "We were severely burned from the saga with Dynamo Kiev. It was extremely difficult for Liel to pick up the pieces after that deal collapsed. This time, we would be very careful with the negotiations with Celtic, and we're extremely confident he will sign. Not many boys of his age would have been able to bounce back from that kind of disappointment and deal with the expectations after that. He will be in good hands at Celtic, and we are waiting at home for the news to be confirmed." Wednesday, the 14th of July, 2021, the National Sports Section. Rangers criticise the decision to allow just 2,000 fans inside Ibrox for Arsenal clash. Rangers have criticised the decision to allow only 2,000 fans inside Ibrox for this weekend's friendly with Arsenal. Gerrs pointed to Euro 2020 as an example of supporters being given more freedom to attend matches inside Hampden, and questioned why their stadium is not permitted to host more people inside. Confirming there will be some fans, at least, in attendance for the Gunners' visit, the Glasgow club revealed there will be a ballot among season ticket holders for tickets to Saturday's match. But in their disappointment, the Light Blues told of their disappointment at the government's decision. Following lengthy discussions with the Scottish Government and local authorities, Rangers have been granted permission to host 2,000 supporters at Saturday's friendly match with Arsenal at Red. Season ticket holders who have access to all games at Ibrox will be given priority, with the balance being balloted among season ticket holders who are MyGers members and have enrolled in the home friendly scheme. Those who are successful in the ballot will receive an email outlining arrangements for Saturday's match. Rangers are disappointed at the small number of supporters being granted access, given the precedent which was set at the Euro 2020 matches at Hampden Park, as well as at other sporting events in Scotland, and the time it has taken to have the number of supporters confirmed by the Scottish Government. Tickets for the Arsenal match are priced at £21 for adults, £16 for concessions, and £10 for kids. Discussions between the club and the relevant authorities continue for the Brighton and Real Madrid game on 24th and 25th of July, and we will update supporters on ticketing plans for those games in due course.
And that was this week's The National Podcast, normally recorded in our studio at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre, currently recorded from our volunteers' homes with the publisher's kind permission. Thanks for listening.